Welcome, welcome, welcome to Jerry Roach's podcast. Continuing with Northern Heights, climbing North America's highest peaks, we are ready for Chapter 6, Archangel, Mount Foraker, 1975. Obsession. When I saw Mount Foraker from Denali in 1963, I thought it was the most beautiful mountain that I had ever seen. The view of Foraker's north face, illuminated by the hand of God, had seared itself into my memory, and I had not forgotten the long, straight ridge splitting the north face that radiated directly to the summit. After Denali, I resolved to climb Denali's Queen someday, preferably by its north ridge. In 1966, I attempted to organize an expedition to Foraker, but my effort didn't get past the planning stage. I did get several excellent aerial photographs of Foraker from Bradford Washburn that showed every face of the mountain, and I pored over them intently looking for my route. I didn't need a magnifying glass. After a first pass through the photos, I knew. The north ridge that I had seen from Denali was the best line on the mountain. The ridge rose arrow straight from glacier to summit. It was not just the best line on the most beautiful mountain that I had ever seen, it was the most beautiful line that I had ever seen on any mountain. In 1967, a desire to get into the St. Elias Range and Lucania lust had consumed me, and I shared my Foraker photos with Gary Lucas and Jerry Halpern before our Lucania climb. Halpern had already climbed high on Foraker's southeast ridge and offered sage advice, but did not want to go back to Foraker. However, the north ridge enchanted Gary, and he said, "It's the best line on Foraker. After Lucania, let's plan another expedition and climb it." I replied, "We'll do it. It's not a question of if, but when. There's one significant problem, though. It's not easy to reach the base of the ridge. It's deep in Denali National Park, far from the park boundary and Wonder Lake. The Park Service doesn't allow aircraft landings or airdrops in the park, so reaching the base of the ridge equipped to climb it is a big challenge. Perhaps we could land on the Kehltna, relay supplies over Crossan, and descend to the Foraker Glacier under the North Ridge." Gary studied the maps for a while, then remarked, "No. The way to get there is to walk in from Wonder Lake." I countered with, "It's too far to relay loads, and we can't carry enough in one load to climb this route. How do we get there with our gear?" Gary looked at me and said the single prescient word, "Horses." He put Washburn's photos aside as if the problem was solved, and we turned our attention to Lucania. Foraker's North Ridge became our dream climb, but unlike Lucania, on Foraker, we resolved to climb to the heights from the tundra. As years rolled by, Dream Climb waited. In 1967, Gary Halpern, Mike Humphreys, and I climbed Lucania in steel. In 1968, Barb and I climbed in Peru with Halpern. In 1969, Barb and I went around the world. In 1970, Gary, Barb, and I were hours from departing for Peru when a giant earthquake hit the Cordillera Blanca region. In a disaster that is hard for Americans to grasp, tens of thousands of people died. We canceled our Peru expedition and shared 7 perfect days climbing in the Cascades Northern Picket Range instead. On that trip, Gary, Barb, and I vowed to do our dream climb together and to dedicate the climb to the lost Peruvians. At the end of 1970, Barb and I climbed in Mexico. In 1971, Barb and I returned to Peru. In 1972, Barb and I climbed in Ecuador. In 1973, Barb and I started our year-long odyssey that included Logan, Mont Blanc, and Kilimanjaro. So many mountains, so little time. Time ran out for Gary in 1973. Indians last saw him walking with a backpack along a road over Peru's Cordillera Negra range. No trace of him was ever found. The best theory was that truckers driving up from the coast with their medieval morals had murdered Gary for his pack and wallet. Dream Climb waited while we grieved for Gary. Our odyssey matured and nurtured Dream Climb. While Barb and I danced and climbed Aconcagua, Dream Climb became an obsession. When we descended from Aconcagua in February 1975, Barb and I were en route to Foraker. The North Ridge was still untouched. Our ascent of this pristine ridge would be a celebration of life, and I named Foraker's North Ridge Archangel Ridge in Gary's honor. Running out of civilization. As we approached Wonder Lake, I pointed intently out the front window of the old yellow school bus and said to my Logan buddy, Charlie Campbell, "Charlie, we're running out of civilization." Charlie peered forward at the expanse of rain-swept Alaskan tundra and summarized, "Goodbye, bus. Hello, heavy-duty wilderness." Looking at Charlie, I continued, "Never mind, Rainier. Logan was just our warm-up climb for Foraker." We stepped off the shuttle bus on June 14, 1975, gazed across a carpet of iridescent tundra, and said goodbye to the internal combustion engine. Our horsebacker, Burl Mercer, was already at Wonder Lake. After months of correspondence, I was happy to meet this tough Alaskan, and he was our key for reaching the Archangel. Our wilderness approach would take us southwest from Wonder Lake under Denali's north side. Then we would continue southwest for many miles to either the Foraker or Heron glaciers that would give us access to Foraker's north side. We had not yet chosen our final approach. Paralleling the range required us to cross many rivers and creeks draining the range, but Burl's horses could give us a ride if any of them were too deep to wade on foot. After we shook hands, Burl swept his hand at the mosquito-filled air and said, "Bugs are bad this year. Lots of standing water. My horses are having a hard time, so let's get going ASAP." I eyed the heavy clouds obscuring the mountains and replied, "Great. One advantage to your horses is that we don't have to wait for flying weather." Burl's exploits were not as famous as Sheldon's or even Jack Wilson's, whom we had flown into Lucania with, but they still led him into the wilderness around Denali. Alaskans like Burl Mercer seldom brag, and newspapers rarely find them. They prefer it that way, as they quietly ply the wilderness with their knowledge and skill. Burl explained our daily routine with the horses. "It takes me a while to get the horses loaded in the morning, but once I start the pack string moving, I don't stop until evening. If I stop, the mosquitoes drive the horses nuts and they throw off their loads. You should plan on hiking independent of the horses and carrying everything you need for the approach march. I can only give you access to the horse loads in the evening. I usually start moving each day around 10 a.m. In order to match my day's mileage, you'll need to start walking at 6 or 7 a.m. Startled, I asked, "Why?" Burl continued, "The horses can move a lot faster than you can across the tundra. Plus, I don't stop for lunch. You are paying me by the day, so it's to your advantage to maximize each day's mileage. Each evening, you and I will sit down and map out the next day's route and campsite." Anxious, I blurted out, "When can we start?" Burl replied, "Tomorrow. Let's spend the rest of today organizing the loads. Then tomorrow afternoon, I'll go down to the McKinley River with a saddle horse and help you get across. If the water is too deep for you to wade, you can ride. Tomorrow night, you camp on the far side of the river, and I'll stay here at Wonder Lake. Day after tomorrow, you start early and beeline for the Muddy River. Don't worry, I'll meet you at the Muddy before evening and ferry you across with the horses. We'll camp on opposite sides of the river again, so you can have a head start the next day." I asked, "How many horses do you have here?" Burl replied, 14. 9 for your team's gear, 3 saddle horses for my wrangler, my son, and me, plus two pack horses for our stuff. Put everything you want the horses to carry over here, and we'll organize it into loads. I replied, No problem. We've already organized our stuff. Wilderness, here we come. A Denali National Park ranger with a crispy new uniform walked up and wanted to know where we were going. I watched as Burl spread out the maps and carefully explained our destination. The new seasonal ranger knew how to help tourists who rode to Wonder Lake on the shuttle bus, but with us she looked puzzled, and it was clear that she didn't know about the park's far reaches. Finally, she stammered, Where's Foraker from here? Burl's lined face and tattered clothing stood in sharp contrast to the ranger's crispy collar as Burl pointed and said, Southwest. Where we're going is farther than you can see from here. The ranger threw up her hands in the air, whirled, peered across the vast tundra, then exclaimed, Oh, you can't go there! Burl and I looked aghast at each other. We had assumed that she would be interested in our adventure. For a long moment, neither of us said anything, while I thought, Oh no, not a bureaucratic pitch! Finally, I said, We've corresponded with the park about our expedition for months. The climbing rangers have already checked us out. You can call headquarters for verification if you want. After the ranger focused on Burl, me, the sturdy horses, and the busy crew packing piles of specialized equipment, she looked embarrassed and said, Oh, I'm sure you're checked out, and it's obvious that you know what you're doing. It just never occurred to me that anyone would go that deep into the wilderness to reach a mountain. I sighed relief and warmed to the easy task of explaining the Archangel's lure to the neophyte ranger. Later that afternoon, Brad Johnson ran up to the tents and said, I found some baby birds in the tundra. I grabbed a camera and we padded carefully across the spongy carpet. Brad found the nest and gently held the tundra open while I quickly snapped photos of the nascent life. I told Brad and Barb, feels like their eagerness symbolizes our new odyssey. I was glad to have Brad on my expedition. The son of Colorado's climbing pioneer and my longtime friend Dale Johnson, Brad quickly took after his climbing father and was now a brilliant alpinist. His confidence on ice would be a big asset on the Archangel. We hunkered in the tents through a brief but heavy rain shower. As the rain dwindled, Dave Wright called out, Look at the rainbow! We all dashed out to watch the black rain clouds scud away under a crisp rainbow. I said to Dave, Check this out! If you stand over here, the rainbow appears to be right over our camp. Look in the tents for gold. I met Dave in the summer of 1974 when we crashed into each other during an impassioned dance rehearsal for the Rudy Perez piece Monumental Exchange. I felt his surging strength, learned that he was an accomplished ice climber, and made a snap decision to invite him on my Foraker expedition. I explained Archangel to Dave, and by the end of rehearsal, without even seeing a photo of the route, he was a team member. While I snapped rainbow photos, the low-lying clouds lifted, revealing foothills. Finally, they lifted enough to reveal a craggy peak. The neophyte ranger, who we had now smitten with our adventure, asked tentatively, Is that Denali? I replied, No, madam. Then my finger slowly traced a long line up the clouds as I said, Denali is up there. The ranger peered through the hole high in the clouds at the unmistakable sheen of a crevassed glacier and gasped, Oh, that one is great. I smiled and said, You're right. As the clouds continued to lift, the Great One's appearance deeply moved all of us. We crouched behind the tents in mock fear, then stood erect in real awe. Greatness moves me every time. I had not seen Denali since 1963, when the Archangel Ridge first caught my eye. Now, 12 years later, I looked at Denali again. The Wickersham wall leapt from the tundra in a sweep that I could not initially comprehend as I stood blinking in the sunlight. I looked beyond Denali for his queen. Where was Foraker? Could we see her at all from here? I walked over to Stuart Krebs, who sat apart from the group, staring southwest through binoculars. I asked him, "Have you seen her yet?" Stu handed me the binoculars, pointed, and said, "Yes, I can just see Sultana's summit above Peter's Dome." I adjusted the binoculars and studied my obsession. The unmistakable summit floated above the range's lesser peaks. My first impression was one of great distance, not great height. Lower peaks hid the Queen's power, and I only saw the top 2,000 feet of the Archangel Ridge. I was far from my goal. Stu was my Foraker team's elder statesman. He had climbed all over the world and brought a wealth of experience to the Archangel. It proved pivotal. Stu and I once shared an intense adventure in the Cascades when we traversed the Chilliwack Range in 3 days and climbed Mount Redoubt, the range's highest peak. We brought a firm friendship out of the Chilliwacks. Now Stu and I hunkered together and spoke in hushed tones as we surveyed the Alaskan wilderness. Six strong, we sat poised for the greatest adventure of our lives. Rivers and Tundra. Stu's wife Barb was not on the expedition, but she sent us off with a unique present. She had taped forward-pointing arrows on our approach march boots. She told us that if we ever got confused about which way to go, look at our feet and the arrows would point in the right direction. Forward, always forward. On June 15, we all gathered at the trailhead. I spun ceremoniously around, stopped, and looked at my boots. The arrows pointed toward the McKinley River. I took a small step for humanity, but a giant step toward the Archangel. We were on our way. The McKinley River is 2 miles from Wonder Lake, and we soon contemplated this unbridged barrier to the wilderness. Many expeditions to Denali's north side have started or ended badly in this river. The braided river's multiple channels spread out in a mile-wide riverbed, and the channel's depth and position constantly change. The river's depth can change several feet in a few hours, depending upon rain on the tundra and sun on the Muldrow Glacier that feeds the river. The glacier-fed river was so murky that we could not see the bottom. Icy water rushed along, carrying snags and rolling rocks with it. Fording this river barrier on foot is always risky, and when the water depth is between your crotch and waist, fording becomes nearly impossible for mortals. Barb and I had not forgotten our epic episode with the McKinley River in 1967, when Barb almost drowned. In 1975, we approached the river with the option of riding across the worst channels on horseback, but with this extra security available, we did not need it. I rolled my pants up over my knees and splashed across all the channels without getting my pants wet. The river was low. We pitched camp on the river's south bank as the expedition's lowest point, about 2,000 feet. That evening, a proud caribou paraded gracefully between us and the still-clear Denali. On June 16, the river rose several feet because of sun on the Muldrow Glacier, and another backpacking party was unable to cross. Fortunately, Burl had no trouble with his horses. We followed a faint trail south along the standard wilderness approach to Denali's north side. After hiking over landmark Turtle Hill, we hurried expectantly on through a lush green tundra fairyland dotted with small lakes. These were some of the lakes that I had seen from high on Denali in 1963, reflecting low sunlight in a vast jeweled concert. I was now at the other end of the concert hall, looking back up at a sparkling Denali. It was not clear which was the better view. One lake was particularly inviting, so we all stripped and took a splashy Arctic bath. We forded the knee-deep Clearwater River without incident, left the Denali approach route, and turned our arrowed boots to the west. After fording rushing Cache Creek, we entered seldom-traveled terrain. We lingered over lunch on a breezy hilltop, gawked at Denali, looked back for the horses, and swatted mosquitoes. When buzzing beasties descended on us in thick clouds, we covered every inch of skin, wore head nets, and evolved a primitive mosquito-swatting game. How many could you kill with one swat? We had simple rules. No baiting, downward swatting, hand pressure only, no mushing, and you must submit to an independent body count. No body parts, identifiable bodies only. We chortled excitedly with each new record. On June 16, the record climbed steadily through the teens. Little did we know that by the end of the approach, Dave would claim the final expedition record of 48 mosquitoes killed with one swat. The record carries an asterisk. Dave did his sophistical swat on Charlie's smelly hat that bent the no-baiting rule. Dave just about knocked Charlie out in pursuit of the record. The breeze traveled elsewhere. Mosquitoes choked us, and we continued west from our hilltop. After crossing onerous Carlson Creek, we bogged along through tough tundra tussocks. Burl charged by with his horses as we descended toward the muddy river. Soon, 14 horses, 8 men, and 1 woman congregated on the torrent's east bank. We did not attempt to ford the muddy river on foot. The Peters Glacier, under Denali's huge Wickersham Wall, feeds the muddy, and the raging water quickly sobered us. The muddy river carries less water than the McKinley River, but it is all in one channel. Denali watched as one by one Burl led each of us across the river on his strongest saddle horse. The only mosquito-free place was the middle of the river. First days on expeditions are special. They separate you from machines and civilization. They launch great adventures and replace dreams with movement. In our case, it was forward arrowed movement. We ended our first full dream day pitching camp on tree-filtered sunlight at 2,500 feet on the muddy's west bank. Our net gain for the day was 500 feet, but we were past the two toughest river barriers between Wonder Lake and the Archangel. We were also over 16 miles closer. Burl retired to his camp on the east bank. Ahead lay terrain that even Burl had not penetrated. Happiness filled me as I prowled the wilderness riverbank on my evening stroll. In the morning, mosquitoes drumming on the tent woke me. As I peeked out the tent vent, Barb asked, "How's the weather?" I sniffed and said, "Overcast. Smells like rain. Chance of mosquitoes today is 100%. We quickly broke our Spartan camp, waved to Burl on the far side of the river, shouldered our packs, and headed west. As I photographed Barb moving into the pastel wilderness, I knew that real adventure was in front of us. On this, our second day, the realities of our wilderness approach settled in. We bogged along through standing water between the tundra tussocks and dodged dozens of small lakes. There seemed to be more water than land. We forded McLeod Creek and bogged on. We were on our own, crossing creeks and rivers during the middle of the day, and some were large enough to give us trouble. They were always cold. The creeks marked our progress. After Iron Creek and its tributaries, we battled Slippery Creek that drains 10,600-foot Peter's Dome north of Denali. Peter's Dome had blocked our view of Foraker from Wonder Lake, but today we saw another peak. Still, I enjoyed our steady progress past the Archangel's barriers. Late in the day, we were tiring as Burl came charging by with his bug-driven horses. We followed the horses through some dense brush thickets under lowering skies, As we swore, swatted, sweated, and slouched through the gruff brushes and bushes, I marveled at Burl's ability to get horses across such rough terrain. We found Burl in our prearranged camp at 2,300 feet near Birch Creek under some low foothills. The long day tired man, woman, and beast. Our net gain for the day was minus 200 feet and 15 forward miles. After we pitched our tent, Barb crawled in, zipped up the mosquito net, killed the mosquitoes inside, and started dinner. I asked, "What's the body count tonight?" After several minutes, she replied, "Ugh, 117 total with 10 in the soup." In the evening, I spread maps out with Burl, and we debated the next day's route. Burl said, "The brush and water were bad today. I'm thinking about taking a high route through the foothills tomorrow." I checked the map and said, "Clever thought. There's a ridge that will take us directly to the Straightaway River. We can certainly hike it, but what are the trade-offs for the horses?" Burl replied, "If we go high, the hazards are snowbanks and rocks. If we stay low and skirt the foothills, the hazards are the same as today, brush and water. When it was clear 2 days ago, I looked at these hills. We can get around the few remaining scattered snowbanks, but this whole operation is a gamble. Let's gamble and go high." The next morning, our spirits soared as we climbed to Birch Ridge. After all the bogging, it felt good to go up again. The footing on the ridge was excellent, and we knew that Burl's gamble would work. We strolled south along the ridge and reached a high point of 4,400 feet. Always on the lookout for grizzly bears, we never saw any. We could not see the high peaks either, but the clouds did allow us expansive views of the tundra and foothills. I reveled in the Alaskan wilderness as we started to turn the corner on the range. Foraker loomed large in my thoughts. Burl came grinning by at noon. I tried to keep up with the horses for a while, but could not match their astonishing pace. We descended west along a small creek and engaged the angry Straightaway River. The large Straightaway Glacier drains Mount Crossan's north side, and I remembered how we crept past Crossan on the Kehillna in 1963. This memory was small solace as we struggled with the swollen torrent. A few miles beyond the Straightaway, we found Burl on the Foraker River's east bank near the snout of the Foraker Glacier at 2,700 feet. Our net gain for the day was 400 feet and 12 miles. I finally touched water from Foraker, but my day was far from over, and I had no time to cheer. Caribou Valley. The biggest decision of our approach, and one of the expedition's toughest choices, now faced me. Would we make our final approach up the Foraker Glacier directly to the Archangel, or go up the Heron Glacier and cross an unknown pass to reach the upper Foraker Glacier? The trade-offs were significant. If we went up the Foraker Glacier, we would eventually get to the Archangel. The problem with this was that it's 12-mile distance. Burl was skeptical about getting his horses very far up this steep-walled valley, and we could spend many days ferrying brutal loads up glacial rubble. One of Earth's great peaks waited for us, and we did not have days to squander struggling in the lowlands. The intriguing alternative was to take the horses farther west, continue up a tundra bench on the Heron Glacier's east side, and get into Caribou Valley that leads to a pass only 3 miles from the bottom of the Archangel. We didn't know if the tundra bench along the Heron was passable to horses, or if the pass at the head of the Caribou Valley was crossable on foot. If Caribou Valley worked, it would be brilliant. If it failed, we would be cut off from our objective, and the expedition could easily fail without even getting to the base of Foraker. Burl's Birch Ridge gamble had worked. As Foraker's water rushed by and clouds rolled lower, I knew it was my turn to gamble. Before I made the decision, I wanted as much information as possible. I dropped my pack and took off up the Foraker Glacier's northeast side with Stu and Barb. I wanted to see how far horses could go along the edge of the menacing glacier. The initial rocky going was not encouraging, but we pressed on. After 2 miles, we knew horses could not navigate this valley. I made my decision in the fog. We would gamble on Caribou Valley. Stu and Barb returned to tell Burl, and I continued alone up the valley. I was after a view of my obsession. I sensed it in the fog-filtered light and started running. I drew on my conditioning and rapidly rounded a bend in the valley. Suddenly, I stopped and felt my beating heart. There was Denali's queen. The unmistakable sheen of sun on a crevassed glacier sifted through a hole high in the clouds. I stared in awe as the hole widened and my view improved. My thumping heart beat the clouds back. As the clouds opened, I tried to understand the enormous mountain. Would I see the Archangel? Then, in one of the most startling moments of my life, I realized that something was wrong. Foraker was not Foraker. Foraker was up. My eye traced a line up the clouds. Foraker was up there. As my blood pulsed through the milling clouds, I sank back into the rock-studded tundra. Foraker's unmistakable summit cone emerged behind and above what I now realized was 9,582-foot Climber's Peak, a peak almost 8,000 feet lower than Foraker had fooled me. Denali's Queen rose aloof with regal grace to an impossible 17,400 feet. I still could not see the Archangel. After 3 hard days of walking, Foraker Summit still floated in sage splendor above and beyond lesser peaks. Clouds quickly snatched the view, and deeply sobered, I returned to camp. That night, a pink glow filled the clouds and spoke of the high peaks. On June 19, with the deep Foraker River safely behind us, we hiked southwest under overcast skies, forded White Creek, then turned south into the Heron Glacier Valley. With each mile, we rejoiced as the bench provided easy passage along the edge of the tortured glacier. A lone caribou welcomed us as we turned into Caribou Valley. I looked at Brad and said, "Half the gamble has worked, but is Caribou Valley a trap?" Rain started in earnest as we walked triumphantly southeast up the gentle valley. We didn't mind the freezing rain since we walked directly toward the Archangel, and the horses still moved our equipment with no effort on our part. Each step forward was a victory. The valley gradually narrowed, and we wondered just how far the horses could go. We just kept rolling along, singing in the rain. When the valley finally steepened, Burl stopped at 4,500 feet, our highest point yet. Burl was eager to start back, so we quickly offloaded the horses and said a soggy goodbye in pouring rain. Poof! Burl and the horses disappeared down the valley, leaving us very alone. Our physical gain for the day was a whopping 1,800 feet and 11 miles, but our logical gain was enormous. Not just because we had come a long way, but because we were so close to Archangel. I checked several maps and announced, "We've walked over 60 miles from Wonder Lake, and we're less than 5 miles from the Archangel." As the rain turned to snow, we jubilantly threw a tarp over our gear and pitched camp deep in the heart of Caribou Valley, close to the Queen. Stay tuned for part two of this amazing adventure to the Archangel Ridge on Mount Foraker in 1975.